From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. David Gessner's life is about the wild and wildness. You may know him first as a nature writer from the books All the Wild That Remains, or My Green Manifesto, or The Tarball Chronicles, or Return of the Osprey. There are five other books. You may have seen him host a TV show for National Geographic called Call of the Wild. Or you may simply know him as a professor and chair of the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. His body of work has garnered a long list of awards, including the John Burroughs Award for Best Nature Essay, a Pushcart Prize, and inclusion in the Best American Non-Required Reading. He's also the founder of the journal Ecotone. If you're meeting him for the first time, we will unpack some of that today, but we'll also explore a different kind of wildness with David Gessner. His newest book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth, is set for a June release. What a pleasure it is to welcome you to Coastline, David Gessner.
Thank you, Rachel. I feel like if we just left it at the intro, that would be, I like that. It was the best intro ever. I appreciate it.
We're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. If you'd like to ask your own question of David Gessner, you can give us a call during the live show on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. David Gessner, so terminology, so many of us lay people, us right. Non-players, think of this game as ultimate frisbee. Is that not correct? You call it ultimate.
Well, I still think you can call it ultimate frisbee, but officially they're trying to get a little more serious. In the 80s, they dropped the frisbee part because frisbee, as you know, is a silly word that sounds like boing, you know, and and the sport has had a lifelong inferiority complex, a kind of Rodney Dangerfield thing going on. And so that's the fight against that, is to try to call it ultimate.
And you actually have a really nice description in your book about this terminology and how it lands on people.
If you play this game, you spend half your life explaining what it is. So this is a little part from the book. If you told someone that you played frisbee seriously, they would understandably regard the phrase as oxymoronic. Once when I was in a doctor's office, the nurse asked how I hurt my shoulder. And when I told her, she simply burst out in laughter. This sort of thing happened all the time. Ultimate frisbee, you told people. Then laughter and a pause as they waited for the real answer. Part of the problem, of course, was that it was a really terrible name. You almost couldn't have come up with worse. An adjective followed by a silly-sounding word, like fabulous foosball.
Now, I have to be honest. I'm doing well to remember that basketball is a game played
there
indoors and football players have helmets. So this was daunting for me. The idea of it was daunting. But while this is a history of ultimate, it's also a memoir and an exploration of wildness and transcendence in a different way. Can you talk about how you experience wildness through ultimate frisbee?
Yeah, and I'm going to couple that with nonconformity, because to start with what we just said about doing something that others consider ridiculous, it takes – you have to build your muscles of nonconformity to be able to throw yourself and your life into a passion that others found silly. It's actually come in handy as a writing teacher, because even though writing we take much more seriously than frisbee, it's the same thing. You're in your 20s, you throw yourself into this, and some businessman at a party says, "What do you do?" And you go, "I try to write," or "I," you know, and you're not published. So how do you sustain in the midst of that? And one of the reasons, to tie it more directly to your question, one of the reasons I sustained, it's because I was also trying to be a writer as well as a frisbee player, was in the pleasure of the wild moments of ultimate. As silly as we might find a frisbee and say you don't play a real sport with a beach toy, there's a great bumper sticker that says, "When a ball dreams, it dreams it's a frisbee." Because a frisbee hovers, and this allows for diving and skying, skying being the ultimate word for going up for it. And it just sits there for you. So if you're running something down with a ball, there's a set trajectory it's going to hit. With a frisbee, it feels almost like it waits for you sometimes. So you can fly through the air and grab it. And it was those moments early on playing as much as winning or losing or anything like that, that hooked me on the game. And I was a very, as a young writer and a young thinker, I was very moment driven, you know, like whether it was a nature moment when your mind quieted and you saw leaves quivering and you said, I'm outside of myself, you know, I'm off the hamster wheel of my mind. Well, Ultimate gave me the same thing. And also drinking gave me that. But often those were coupled with Ultimate, and drinking kind of went together.
So. You use the past tense when you talk about thinking of life in terms of moments. Is that no longer?
I think, you know, I'm 56 years old now, so I'm a little less moment driven. I still have my moments, bad pun, but very much so. You know, I always feel like I read Walden in high school and never recovered. And I read all the romantics then, and it got in me. So my 20s were very much devoted less to concrete achievement and more toward that moment seeking, I would say.
It took you, you write that it took you 20 years to publish this book.
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
Because of what we first talked about. The question we often got during my day when you told people what you did and you were very passionate about it was, is that the thing you do with dogs? And now what you get is, oh, we have a course near our house. They're talking about frisbee golf. Still, a lot of people don't get it. So I never took it seriously as a subject when I was a young writer. In fact, my first book is about, you know, my dad's death. And I quote, it's a quote from Thoreau, it is a wild, rank place and there is no flattery in it. So I wrote about these serious topics. But then that book got a little press and a big agent at ICM wanted to pick me up. And she said, let's see all your stuff. So I sent her a novel, a memoir, and I sent her this short proposal about Ultimate Frisbee. And she said, let's do this one. We're going to do this one. So I went back and played with Boston, then the world champion and national champion, as a kind of George Plimpton, I'm going to play along and write this book. Played at a tournament, drove back to Cape Cod where I was living, went to bed at 9, woke up at midnight and started writing. Remember, I've been writing for 20 years, but I'd never touched Ultimate as a subject. It didn't seem serious. I wrote for the next week in a way I've never written before, barely sleeping. I took the oral tradition of the sport and spilled it out onto the page and thought, oh my God, this is so fun. And I was like laughing out loud the way I never do with writing. Sent it to her. She loved it. And I remember we had $50 in my wife and I in our joint bank account at the time. She told another writer friend, I'm going to sell this for big bucks. And it was just like Ultimate, the way it always kind of screws you over the end. I went down to New York. I talked to editors. It looked good. And the publicists and marketers in the end said, is that the thing you do with dogs? And it was classic, you know. And so that book died and it was a hard loss. I put it aside, published parts of it as an essay a few years later, and the essay kind of caught on. And now that the Olympics are looking at it as a sport, suddenly, and I've had, you know, 6 more books since then, suddenly I could push for it. And so it took 20 years to get it back to this moment, really.
So this could become an Olympic sport. It is not yet, but it could be.
It is not yet. We're really riding the could very hard in our community because they're looking at it. They're putting it into the World Games. It would be a great Olympic sport, but I'm not here to proselytize.
We're talking with David Gessner today, author of 10 books and professor and department chair of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. His newest book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession, and My Wild Youth, is set to be released next month by Riverhead Books. You talk about this game, and this is why I, as a non-sports person, it really is a blind spot. I could enter this world. You talk about it as being a gateway into some sort of transcendence of the individual mind or self. You write, I can suddenly hear the breathing of the player I am defending and know where that man will cut before he does. Right. What do you mean by that?
I think I mean a little bit what we were just saying before about I'm a writer. I think too much. I whirl around in my brain a lot. And those animal moments were some of my favorite, you know, moments of my youth. And it was, you know, I don't like the phrase, you know, flow and you know, some of these new age phrases. But really, those moments when you're so absorbed in the thing that you're gone, basically. And, you know, you're becoming as strong and vital and as you ever are. And weirdly, when I talked about writing that the stuff on Cape Cod when I cranked out those pages, the writing was a little like that too at that time. It was like I could hear the breathing, kind of that kind of primal thing going on. And so I always held those moments very highly. Also, there was another aspect to it. I'm actually jealous of the people I teach in the creative writing program at UNCW because of their sense of community. I wrote alone for all those years. I didn't know, my teammates made fun of me because I was obviously a failed writer. I hadn't published yet, and they were very harsh anyway. But
we're talking about before 30, right,
before
in your life.
I was 35 when I published my first book. So the thing that Ultimate gave me is being part of a tribe, a community. You know, no one knew my name anywhere else, but within that world, I had a name, but I also had a place. I had 16 teammates who were my good friends, and it gave me something in that way, too.
So then, Professor Gessner, do we overuse the intellect?
I certainly found that what broke me free as a writer, I'm not going to mention any drug use or anything like that, but ways to, ways to circumvent, you know, the overthinking process and just get it down there. In fact, I used to metaphorically think of going up for a disc. If you were good at going up for a disc in the air, it was a very direct thing. You saw it floating there. There were all these other people trying to get it, but you go right for it. And I thought of that metaphorically as something that I wanted to do with my writing as a young writer, like bluntly and directly and honestly get at the thing itself. And that required, ditching the intellect a little bit.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Award-winning author David Gessner is with us on this Wednesday. His new book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession, and My Wild Youth comes out next month. When we come back from this break, we'll learn a little more about his relationship with his father. And this live Wednesday show is your chance to ask your own question of David Gessner. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today with David Gessner, award-winning nature writer, professor, and chair at UNCW's Creative Writing Department, founder of the journal Ecotone, and author of the new book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth. You can ask your own question of David Gessner on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. David Gessner, your father was not, as we open up this can of worms, not the most effusive person on the planet.
No.
It doesn't sound like he was the most supportive guy offering encouragement in your interests and your pursuits. Tell us about your father in your childhood. He had this tradition of handing out trophies. Kid of the Year trophies and runner-up. Tell us about that.
First, I want to say my daughter Hadley thinks I'm tough and she knows nothing. When I'd get a 98 on a test, my dad would say, "Where are the other 2 points?" You know, like. But he was an insanely competitive person, and he, you know, like I should have beaten him in tennis when I was 13, but he used mind control to keep me under for a couple more years. And he would – the weirdest thing he did was he started giving out these awards for Kid of the Year. There were 4 siblings. And he would give them out kind of randomly. It didn't seem like once a year. And I'd never win because I was the firstborn male, and apparently I was supposed to be able to take it. And it was a silly thing, but he'd do – he'd actually finally got trophies made down at this downtown sports store. But they were little trophies without tennis players or – swimmers, they just stood there doing nothing, and they'd say Kid of the Year on them. And, you know, it was silly. And the thing about it is, it sounds creepy, but there was humor to it, too, the way he would do it.
It sounds mean.
Yeah, it was a little mean. But he, my mom finally made him give out 4 awards to all of us if we were going to, you know, if he was going to do this. And I know I never won, but when I was writing this up, I actually found the little trophy in the crawl space of our house and brought it out. And I remembered one time where I was either second or third. He would give it away in the manner of beauty contests in kind of reverse order till he got to Kid of the Year. So I looked down at my trophy and it said, Kid of the Year, participant. So, but you know what? It does sound mean taken away, but he was an achiever, a reader, and he was funny too. So, you know, and I mentioned in the book, he was kind of a Harvard snob, but not in a Thurston Howell sort of way. He looked kind of like Lou Grant more, and it was kind of a chortling teasing, which I've incorporated somewhat. I like to think I'm a little more sensitive.
Did your father attend Harvard?
He did, yeah. But he let everybody know it in a way that was not like, oh, I went to Harvard. It was more like, oh, you went to a lesser school. so it was something to deal with.
Did your father approve of your obsession with Ultimate Frisbee?
I think you know the answer. It was insane to him that I would get out of college and dedicate my life to chasing a spinning piece of plastic. And writing was equally insane to him because he really didn't have a concept. The weird thing is when I finally at 30 went back to grad school for writing, he could get his head around that. It was more traditional. He was like, oh, he's going to school for writing. It's normal. But these more amorphous kind of crazy things, because I also was trying to be a political cartoonist, so I had three strikes against me. But he was not super supportive. But we had moments. He died when he was my age now, actually. But before he died, he read some of my stuff, and we actually had a good period of about a year of more close to a friendship than brutal enemies.
And you don't write about your father as though there's bitterness there. You seem to recognize him as a guy who had his own limits as a human being,
He strove for, you know, he was an ambitious guy, and there were lots of good qualities there, and they came through too. They're not as funny to tell as the meaner stories, though.
And you actually say that you learned to be self-deprecating as kind of a defense mechanism against the criticism that you knew would come.
Exactly. I would say my sense of humor developed in defense against his attacks. I would make fun of myself before he could. And that's part of where it came from, yeah.
And do you think – is that a real thing? Do you think that you're more comfortable with criticism or rejection than most people are, or are you just better able to deal with it?
I think I was terrible at rejection and criticism. And another thing I talked to grad students about, I think I was super sensitive about it because I didn't show my writing to anybody for the first 15 years, even my girlfriend at the time. And when I finally started to send it out, of course, I got rejections. And I'd say I'm great at it now because but it took a long time to take the thing you care most about in the world that you've really labored over and let somebody else ridicule it or not even ridicule it, just reject it. It's not an easy thing.
Can't leave your father yet.
Let's keep on him. We could turn this into a therapy session. We could just talk about him the rest of the time. No problem.
But the theme of father-son also pops up in another book, especially in All the Wild That Remains. You're writing about Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey. Wallace Stegner, one of the two writers that you're profiling in All the Wild That Remains, his relationship with his father wasn't good. And you wonder a lot about that relationship out loud on the pages.
Yeah.
And you wonder about the scenes that wind up in Stegner's fiction, how much of that was taken from his own life. And you ask if he ever got beyond hating his father.
Right.
And you talk about how intellectually he knew his father had a rough life. But still, so what did you conclude about Wallace Stegner on that front?
Well, he was dealing with something a little different. His father died in murder-suicide, basically, and also really physically beat him, something my father never did. And a lot of his personality developed in response to that father. He became very cultivated and bookish and restrained because his father was this crazy boomer character who would chase around after gas or oil or not gas, but like diamonds and tear the family up rootlessly, whereas Stegner was very rooted. So his was a response. And I think it's interesting. Another aspect of that is I looked at Abbey and Stegner a little bit as two pseudo-fathers for me, in a way, like one providing the wildness and one kind of the restraint. And and so I think one thing that my books have been about is a search for fathers in a lot of ways. One thing I've come to realize later is the huge importance of my mother. I was just down at our Cape Cod house packing it up after 50 years. I always called it my father's house. Finally, I'm getting it right. It's my mother's house. She's the one who made it a home for us. And so it's just interesting how looming a figure he was for me. Yeah.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking today with David Gessner, author of 10 books. He's also a professor and department chair of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. His newest book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth, is set to be released next month by Riverhead Books. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Lindsay from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you so much. I just wanted to make a comment to David. I have had the pleasure of playing pickup with him.
Hey, Lindsay,
here in Wilmington.
How are
you? And I just wanted to comment that there is that beautiful sense of camaraderie. It's a great community, and just looking forward to reading his book. So congrats, David.
Thank you. The community is insane how big a part of it had in my life. Like one of the climactic parts of the book is I find out I have testicular cancer when I'm 29, and then a week later when I turn 30, I found out I have the good flavor of cancer. And I had a party, and all these people came, you know, I looked around the room and almost all of them were Ultimate players, including my girlfriend of the time. And I realized, you know, it was like kind of the true meaning of Ultimate sort of thing. I'd never won Nationals, which had been my big quest to win it all. But I had this community kind of rally around me at that moment. And I kind of, realized from then on that that's really what I'd gotten out of Ultimate. Yeah.
Lindsay, thank you so much for your call. Talk about that a little bit. There's a term that you use. Is it a Greek term in the book?
Arete. Yeah,
yes, yeah. That's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
So what does that mean?
Well, it's a Greek term for athletic excellence, but excellence overall, like striving toward this high ideal. And during the years I played, it was starting to fade. There was an earlier period in California where a player named Tom Kennedy was what I called the good great man. Like he was a great player, unbelievable. One year won the distance and accuracy competition outside of Ultimate with, you know, throwing a frisbee. But he also was a good guy. And he, you know, Ultimate has this thing called the spirit of the game where people make their own calls. And TK managed to win the national championship but not be a jerk. And that was as my people, like I came around in the age of Reagan and Boston and New York, suddenly grooviness was out and winning was in. And since you made your own calls, cheating started to muscle its way into the sport. People would call themselves in when they were out. And win at all costs kind of took over. So I kind of look back at TK as this period of arete before the sport kind of started to be more cutthroat.
Is that still part of the game? Do people still make their own calls in the game, or are there officials?
Yes and no. They do at the national level. Like, I always thought it was ridiculous. I was a cynic about the spirit of the game. I had worked all year and trained, and now I'm going to go into this game where somebody's going to make their own call objectively. It's just not going to happen. It's this kind of perfectionism of man kind of ideal, right? So, but now they have it, but they also have observers who make calls that the people can't possibly make. So it's a little bit of a compromise. They tout spirit of the game, but it's still a little iffy. You know, one thing that's changed, a current player told me, as far as bad behavior, which, by the way, Wilmington teams were notorious. I had never heard of Wilmington. I played this team, Port City Slickers. They were the worst spirited team I'd ever played. So Wilmington is historically notorious for being a mean team, you know, which is – and they – UNCW won the national championship, I think, in 93. But they were tough guys.
Does UNCW still have
– They do. The Seamen.
And – All right. Well, speaking of kind of the characterization of Ultimate, you talk about smoking joints on the sidelines, drinking beer during the game. The team names were the Hostages, the Seven Boozy Idiots, Chicks and Salsa, Lady Godiva.
This is all very long time ago, I want to point out.
Of course, the all-Jewish team, Let My People Throw.
Yes.
So why so irreverent?
Well, you know, when I said the spirit of the game, a lot of people think of Ultimate as kind of hippy-dippy spirit, and there was certainly some of that. But I think it came out, I think I say in the book, out of the same cauldron that produced National Lampoon, Saturday Night Live. It was like a screw you kind of like anything goes spirit. We can go into Joel Silver if you want a little bit later, but from the beginning there was a jokey aspect. And since no one else took our sport seriously, we, much like I was self-deprecating and deprecating in the face of my father, we were a self-deprecating sport. In fact, not long ago at Nationals, filmed on ESPN, this group of players in the stand started to chant, "Not a real sport, not a real sport." So there was always that aspect to it.
And speaking of irreverence and how not seriously it's been taken, and smoking joints on the sidelines.
All those.
Yeah. You got very serious about the sport and decided that you were going to be kind of a purist, training for one particular season. You weren't going to consume copious amounts of beer. You weren't going to smoke pot.
That's right. That's right.
And you have a
health nut.
Yes, section you can read from the book on that.
Okay. So this was when I met one of my closest friends. His name was Honerkamp, but I called him Hones. And I'll just read from here. Hones and I headed into his bedroom, where I admired the decor. His room was already taking on the hoarder's flavor it would more fully realize later on. I'm going to skip a little bit. The decor seemed very cool to me back then, as did his bamboo bong that had no base and rested in a gray ceramic mug, though in truth it rarely rested. Not in that house. He sat at a small schoolboy's desk, and I took the seat next to him in the crowded bedroom. He used an upside-down frisbee as a dish to separate the seeds from the pot. He packed a little hit for himself. While he pulled in the smoke and the bong gurgled, I told him how I'd quit smoking pot. "This is the year I'm going to keep my body in perfect shape," I said drunkenly. "This is the year I'm going to put everything into Ultimate." He nodded, holding the smoke in his lungs, as I continued on in this vein, describing the rigors of my workouts and the deep level of my commitment, and of course the discipline it would take to not smoke pot for the entire fall. I went on and on about my training, and God help me, I may have even mentioned arete. When I finished my lecture, and after he'd finally exhaled in a great cloud, Hones refilled the bowl with a finger pinch and tilted the bong toward me. "Want a hit?" he asked. "Sure," I said. Soon the water was burbling and I was sucking the smoke into my lungs. It was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. So,
and that isn't just about you tossing a resolution out the window in the moment. I mean, this again seems to align with kind of a deeper theme.
Yeah, I mean, I actually as a writer, this is kind of a little bit off topic, but I found that making resolutions is a wonderful thing in two ways. One is that you sometimes stick to your resolution. Two is that you rebel and it's creative energy to go against the resolution. So I had two seasons I played with the Boston team where I didn't drink, or I actually did stick to it. Unfortunately, we would then lose in the semifinals of Nationals. And the very first thing I would do is reach for a beer.
But, and you, I think that you credit the sport with turning your sex life on its head, in a manner of speaking.
In terms of, oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I That's I'm it's going to be interesting to have my ex from that time, my ex-girlfriend, not read the book. But her name has been changed to protect the semi-guilty. but I was going down to a tournament with Hones, the same guy I just read about, when I realized I'd forgotten my cleats. And I went back to the apartment, opened the door to get the cleats, and found her in bed with another gentleman. I did not react in kind of macho fashion. I just went over and got my cleats and left. But so Ultimate helped me discover that as well.
The hunger of youth is for greatness. You quote that in, I think, at least two books.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change with age?
I think it does. I think it's less fevered, you know, and feverish. I think if there's also an epigraph in there, To My 20s by Kenneth Coke, which says, 20s, I'd go back to you in a second if I could. But I'd like to go back to those 20s with my current brain, you know, or calmness, so that you could – to combine those two things would be wonderful. And I think the best athletes and artists combine that kind of energetic ambition with a more – I wish I'd been a little saner in my early 20s. But I do admire the energy of that time. And I do think that ambition is underrated. We too quickly say – oh, you know, it's bad to have those big goals. But it helped me. It pushed me. I just would like to do it with I'd like to have youthful ardor and middle-aged sanity, I guess.
we're about to go to break. We'll talk about when you finally leapt into writing and what role Ultimate Frisbee played in either maybe keeping you from that, what kind of energy went into that. When we come back from this break, you're listening to Coastline. Our guest today is David Gessner. When we come back from this break, you'll have one more chance to ask your own question. You can do that on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. David Gessner has written 10 books, won a host of awards. He chairs the creative writing department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and he plays Ultimate Frisbee. His newest book, set to be released next month, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth, is published by Riverhead Books, a division of Penguin Random House. You can ask your own question of David Gessner on this Wednesday by calling us today at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. David Gessner, you thought of yourself as a writer, and mm-hmm. you had the ambition to be a writer for, it sounds like, most of your adult life. Early on, that you knew you wanted to do that, but you didn't leap into the world of writing as early as a lot of people who are that clear do. Can you talk about that gap between what you imagined of yourself and then what you actually did?
Sure. During the break, you mentioned Walter Jackson Bate, who was my professor at Harvard, and he talked about these grand ideas like a new romanticism that was going to be after postmodernism, and it kind of infected me a little bit in a good way and a bad way. In a good way, in that through him, I read the biographies of Keats and Samuel Johnson and learned a lot, and he was a really wise man in a lot of ways, but in a bad way in that I got very grandiose about the writing process. And what that served to do was paralyze me, basically. I thought if what I'd put down on the page isn't Keats-worthy, then I shouldn't be putting anything down at the page at all. And I managed not to write much at all. I was a political cartoonist in college. I managed not to write much at all and then moved to Cape Cod after college and said, now I'm a writer. And that paralyzed me even more, you know, just this grand pronouncement. But gradually, I started to write, and then I started to write daily. And even though I would say I finished my first book when I was about 27, and then I set right out to write another after that one got rejected. So even though I didn't publish, I got into the habit of daily writing. And I actually credit sports to some degree for that, the dailiness of the discipline. I think they really, you know, the working out and the writing really were mirrors of each other in a nice way. Just as Frisbee, in a way, was a metaphor for the writing, you know, this kind of grand quest for glory, but, you know, they fed each other in a way. So you asked before the break about how much did it hurt or help writing, how much did Ultimate hurt or help? I'd say, you know, obviously it hurt in the sense that I was throwing so much energy into this thing that was not just athletic but social and involved partying and everything, and it took away from the writing. But on the other hand, I wasn't ready yet to publish those books. And it gave me a world where I did have an audience, not as a writer but as an athlete, and it gave me a community and things that if I'd just been sitting there in the cold of the Cape Cod house trying to write the great novel, I might have been, you know, one step away from the asylum, basically, you know. So I think it, you know, in the end, it was a very nice handoff. I think in the book I say it's like Tarzan swinging from vine to vine. 96 was the last year I played at Nationals. 97 was the first book. So that went well.
And speaking of Professor Walter Jackson Bate, you revealed to a friend of yours, and this is one of the stories in Ultimate mm-hmm. Glory, that you ached to talk with him. You admired him so much.
Yeah.
It was just so lovely the way you described your love of this man.
Right.
And then your friend saunters over to him one day in the dining hall.
And they become buddies, and he takes him out to the farmhouse in New Hampshire and reads him Archibald MacLeish's poetry and does this, you know. And I was very jealous at the time. But I think it's funny. I'm a pretty outgoing person at this point in my life, how I wasn't that way back then. And he meant too much. He symbolized too much for me to approach. Finally, after I'd had the operation for testicular cancer, I got up the courage to write him. And now by now I'm 30. And he wrote back and we met. And then he invited me up to that farmhouse. And at one point during that experience, he read from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, and he finished and said, "The last time I read that was at Eliot's funeral service," at which point I was like, oh, my God, I've been transported to this literary stratosphere. And he also told me to let go of my first novel, which was great advice because, you know, you cling to those first things. And he helped me move on to the next book.
It sounds like so much of the creative process in producing is letting go of things and stripping away
yes.
instead of this youthful notion of creating and grandiosity and adding things. And
yeah. At UNCW in the creative writing department, you know, we have theses for the grad students. On the one hand, you want them to throw everything and cling to that because how do you do art without obsession? In a lot of ways, all my books are about being obsessed with something, whether it's ospreys or frisbees, you know. So how do you do something like that without being obsessed? On the other hand, how do you then turn away from it and say, okay, you served your purpose, on to the next obsession? And those are hard things to do.
We're talking with David Gessner. He's the author of 10 books. He chairs the Department of Creative Writing at UNCW. And his newest book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee, Obsession, and My Wild Youth, is set to be released next month by Riverhead Books. Taylor writes, "I, being a 24-year-old man and in a current career that I couldn't imagine myself being involved in for the next 20-something years, try to write for sanity and creativity's sake. My works were loved at college, but more recently I was rejected by 3 publishers in the span of 12 hours. What is a coping method I could apply to myself when the toaster is about to be submerged in the bathtub?"
Yeah, yeah. I am a big advocate of anger. "I'll show the bastards" was a way I used to, because, you know, you're really being hit in the face or in the gut with those things. And you reel at first because you've put so much into something and you've rejected it. And I'm not joking. I mean, I had "I'll show the bastards" on a card. And I used to joke with my wife, they keep trying, but they can't destroy me. You know, like that was kind of became a prideful thing, like almost a superpower, like that you could be rejected and come back from it and rejected and come back from it. So I think we talk – there's a long ago quote from Hawthorne that I won't get right that Melville liked, which is to be a writer requires incredible sensitivity and delicacy and also incredible exterior toughness.
Yeah.
And I think the toughness part – I would suggest to Taylor to listen to Springsteen's Tougher Than the Rest, you know, and get into that mindset of like, I've got this beautiful, sensitive part, but I also – another part of me has to fight for that beautiful, sensitive part.
You know, since we're talking about this, you are pretty critical of that first novel that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember exactly why. You talk about you actually had characters in it quoting
Thoreau.
Yes, yeah. To each other.
Well, that's a little bit, you know, to be honest,
yeah.
Since we're kind of gone the therapy therapy session route anyway, that's a little bit of a lie.
Oh.
Because I'm proud of that first novel. That's a little bit of my father's self-deprecating joke. I finally cracked the first novel by making it in journal form, and it was about a brother with his brother going kind of crazy long before my brother actually did. And in journal form, I could get the nature of Cape Cod and the kind of wild, swirling Van Gogh feel of the fall in it. And when I look back and read it, I think, well, this is a publishable book. I just didn't get it published, which is another thing to tell Taylor. There's lots of good work out there that – you know, maybe that editor was in a bad mood that morning when they read the book. And that's a hard thing to get your head around, but it's the reality of getting stuff into the world.
Isn't there something also, too, just about developing as an artist and being okay with putting work out there that sucks? Do you have any work that you would look at now and you would say, that is cringeworthy, but that doesn't define me as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't go that far just because it took me till I was 35, and by then I was on my feet. But certainly if some of that early stuff I was dying to get out there was out there, yes, I would cringe for sure.
Getting back to Professor Bate,
mm-hmm.
later in life, you wrote a piece
I wrote an essay, you know, I was called On Being Boswell's Boswell, like because he was a biographer, and about my experience in New Hampshire. And it got published by – it got accepted for publication by a prestigious literary journal. I sent it to him also. And I came back from cross-country skiing on a trip. And back then we had these things called answering machines. And I hit it. and the first was, beep, this is Stratus Havarius of the Harvard Review. We love your piece. We are going to publish it. And I was dancing around celebrating when it went, beep, this is Stratus Havarius of the Harvard Review. Walter Jackson Bate has – gotten in touch, and he says, we can't publish that piece. You know, it's awful. And I was like, awful? I thought it was a tribute. Well, he sent me this marked up copy of it, and I wrote about his hands a lot because they would tremble, and I thought they were very dramatic. And he circled every mention of hands. He said, hands, hands again. This writer has a mania for hands. And it was this crazy marked up thing from what I thought was the sanest man I knew. So,
How did that feel?
You know, it was one of those show the bastards moments. You know, I had to come off the map from that one. Eventually, the piece did get published in the Georgia Review, and that was after Bate had died. And so, you know, the way I spin it in my head is all of us have these irrational sides, no matter how sane, and Bate had one too.
Mm-hmm.
But he strove through his writing and work toward a better sanity.
And this came, his criticism of your piece came after you had actually formed a friendship with him.
Yeah.
You spent some time with him.
It was a brief window of friendship between the not talking to him and him hating me. So, yeah. But yeah.
Can you talk about what that experience was like, going to his house and spending time with him and having him sort of coach you through letting go of your first work?
It was extraordinary. You know, that's when he quoted the Eliot to me, and that's when I, you know, it was kind of like having Gandalf put his staff on your shoulder. And in fact, the essay was called Benediction that I wrote about it. So, yeah.
Mark from Wilmington says the sport of Ultimate has changed quite a bit. It's gotten more competitive. The connotation on the air is connecting Ultimate to marijuana. But if you were to go to a league game with Cape Fear Ultimate, it's not anything like that. It's competitive. It's fun. No marijuana smoking on the sidelines. I'm frustrated to hear this, and I don't want listeners to think it's a bunch of hippies playing frisbee.
Wonderful question. So that's a big part of the book, too. I say at the beginning, we were the men in the leather helmets. I mean, I started playing in the 70s. And one of the things – I actually have a piece in Outside magazine this month about Bo Kittredge. I'm glad he wrote that. The athleticism is at a much higher level. You do not have the wafting smells that you had once in my day. I love seeing where Ultimate's heading, and I love being able to watch the college nationals on ESPN and, you know, the pro leagues as well. So – yeah, the book starts with my story, but evolves toward that, like the larger sport. And I'm very hopeful, as I said at the beginning, the physics of Ultimate make me very hopeful as well. The better athletes playing, you see top 10 plays on SportsCenter now quite frequently, and it's exciting. You know, it was exciting to have been there back then in the bad old days, but it's more exciting to be heading toward the future with it.
What brought you to North Carolina?
It's again, a joke that is only about 70% true, but Return of the Osprey ends. I will stay on Cape Cod forever. And my joke is that Becky Lee, who is a professor at UNCW, read the book and talked to her colleagues. And I came, you know, that's how I ended up in North Carolina. They read and asked me to apply for the job here. So I moved down here 14 years ago.
14 years ago.
Yeah.
And you took that job, and I know you might want to be a little careful here, but that was, you know, in earlier days, you might have made different kinds of decisions.
Right.
In service of wildness.
And in service of place. You know, like, I would say my relationship with Wilmington, including with Masonboro and the Cape Fear, and is been a very good one, but it's an arranged marriage versus a passionate love affair that I had with Cape Cod and Boulder. And it's been interesting to find that I can use the tools that define those other places for me, bird watching being a big one and learning the waters and learning nature to kind of root down here. Because for my daughter, this is where she's always lived. And so this is home for me.
You wrote a piece for Orion Magazine, which is – that's the piece that won the John Burroughs Award for Best Nature Essay called Learning to Surf.
Yeah, yeah. It was – we moved down here when she was – my daughter was 3 months old, and it was very chaotic. And I had no idea – we had an unair-conditioned car, and so putting her inside it was like sliding her into a kiln.
Yeah.
You know, and I had no idea of the heat down here. So all – and I was starting the job. Everything was going on at once. So I decided, of course, to learn how to surf.
And you describe this. You say it's the kind of heat that makes you want to lie down and give up,
yeah,
to start to cry and throw out your arms and surrender. I've known brutal cold in my life, but cold has the advantage of invigoration, at least initially.
Yeah, I've gotten a little used to it, but it was tough at first. In fact, I was just up on Cape Cod and had a very fallish day, and I flew back and came out of ILM at night and the blast of, you know, but yeah.
So
no offense, Wilmingtonians.
Well, yeah, so let's offend a little bit more.
Right,
how do you like teaching now? The lure of the steady paycheck, the insurance, because now you've got a wife and a daughter, reason over passion, intellect, driving.
I just wrote something about teaching and how I didn't come into it with great ideals, and I came into it somewhat reluctantly, mm-hmm, and I more and more am so happy I did. And it really ties back to what we were talking about earlier. Those struggle, I feel like I'd like to have myself from when I was 24 in the class and say, hey, you idiot, you know, show your work to other people, you know, write, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but shitty first drafts and you know, and keep moving forward. And the things that I learned through hard experience, it's nice to be able to communicate.
David Gessner's soon-to-be-released book, Ultimate Glory, Frisbee Obsession and My Wild Youth, published by Riverhead Books, a division of Penguin Random House. A release party is happening June 6th.
At Riceville Beach Brewery at 7 o'clock.
That's this edition of Coastline. David Gessner, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Caleb Covington engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.